We are back once again, 283rd time. It's great to be back. It's great to have you with us. We're going to have a great show today. I'm feeling it in my bones. We're going to have a great show. I appreciate you stopping by. I know most of you are return members of the congregation, and I do thank you for coming back. If you are new, it's your first time listening, I ask simply that you listen to the entirety of the show. We do have a Christian-specific segment. That's roughly the halfway point of the show. And believe me, sometimes it's very roughly. We'll get into it a little lot earlier and sometimes later. Just depends on how it works out. Listen to it. Give it a chance. It's not going to be, you mean, I don't need to be here in a minute. It's Jesus stuff. I encourage you to give it a chance. But if you're going to spurg out over it, I've warned you, so don't whine at me either. If you're like, well, I refuse to listen, well, go to hell. I don't care. But you have been warned. But I do encourage you to give it a try. You might find that you actually get something out of it. And, you know, again, that's up to you. If you do get something out of the show, don't be shy. Pay those tithes. I'm passing the plate around. I do it right now. We have the one and only ultimate privacy coin. That's right. Snail mail. Look here on the description page for the Parish of the Patriots. There it is. If you need help, ask your grandmother how to fill out an envelope. It's very easy. There's no blockchain. We use the ultimate blockchain of diversity of the post office to pass it along. It's very, very much appreciated. With that having been said, we get into the listener supporter mailbag. Grandpa Dan, I'm glad to have found your segments of the Parish of the Patriots. After more than 100 episodes, I can say your content has made a great impact on my life, from the first part of the shows helping me to make more sense of the world, to your Christian-specific segment helping me to understand and draw closer to God. I've also included a donation for Sven. I look forward to listening to many more episodes with you, and am keeping you, Sven, and Mr. Johnson in my thoughts and prayers. Sincerely, Quentin. Thank you very much, Quentin. And there's a PS here I left out, and apparently this person's going through and listening to old shows. You have my sympathies. The show, you're listening to peak now. Because early on, it was pretty rough. Hey, I'll be the first to lie, because we were trying to figure this thing out. I had an idea of what I wanted this show to ultimately be, but getting that formed up took some time. So if anybody goes back and listens to older shows, you know, they're pretty rough, you know, because I was trying to get this all figured out of what I wanted it to be, and it was a little clumsy, a little embarrassing, but everything is always a process. And so, yeah. You know, now the PS included, apparently if you go in some of the really older shows, that they're not working or whatever. Look, I'm doing all I can to keep the current stuff up. It just is what it is. And you're not going to find anything better than what we got now, because it's peak. It's peak now, because we've got this kind of ironed out now, kind of the format, kind of what we're looking to do. It's good stuff. I do have one more. I'm saving that for the Christian-specific segment, so we'll do that one there. We're done. We're done with that. We're 3 minutes in. I've already hit you up for money. I've already passed the plate around. I've already done the listener supporter mailbag, and we're rocking. We're moving along. Things are spicy in Britain. I kind of touched on this. I'm recording the show on Sunday this week, by the way, just so you know, give you some time context. I always say, if something big happens on Monday and you're like, why isn't he talking about this on his show? It's because I'm recording it on Sunday. But things are still spicy in Britain. I talked about this a little bit on the Friday Daily Nationalist show, but I kind of kept that in the context of, you know, the discussion about the parameters of discussion, how this causes a problem, because the government only allows you to speak of things in context. You know, and in Britain, for instance, you're not allowed to talk about it in the context of race at all. That's a violation of the law. So people will talk about it in the form of religion, and you wind up with people throwing rocks at a mosque when the person doing the stabbing wasn't Muslim at all. They were from Rwanda, and part of the problem. But I thought we'd get into it just a little bit, and I want to get into something else. I'm not going to talk about this, but the things are being spicy there. And from an American perspective, I look at Britain, and they're further along, further along downhill, down the descent than here in the U.S. You just had this election and the Tories got blown out. Now, here's the thing, that isn't because people woke up one day and suddenly really supported everything Labour was for. The Tories were supposed to be in opposition to the Labour Party. Well, they've held on to power for years, which means that for years people opposed the open policies of the Labour Party. Well, all of a sudden the Tories get blown out. It isn't because all these people that voted for the Tories for years suddenly switched, changed their mind, and decided, yes, we want more immigration. What that was the people throwing up their hands and simply saying, we're done with the system. This was a sign. People are sitting here, oh boy, the people really suddenly switching to Labour. What does this mean in the context for the Tories? Like it's a sports game match. And I've said that this is a dangerous signal to the system that it's lost legitimacy. This was simply people throwing up their hands and going, it doesn't matter. Now, in the U.S., we're not there yet because you still got all these people putting their faith in the great orange hope that Trump is going to turn this thing around and fix all the problems of America. And they're being set up. If Trump gets in there, they're being set up for a really, really big letdown. If one of the most dangerous things for the system is if Trump gets in there, not because he's going to do something to change the system, but because people put so much faith, it's turned into a personality cult. They put so much hope into Trump that if he gets in there, nothing changes. You get more of the same. Then you're going to get closer to what we're seeing in Britain now, where the system doesn't have legitimacy. Now, the politicians in Britain are just completely they're showing how inept they are in the way that they're handling it. They keep throwing fuel on the fire, and you can tell they don't even understand that that's what they're doing. They're like, why are things getting worse? Because you morons are literally throwing fuel on the fire. For instance, violence and anger and anti-immigrant sentiment blew up over these stabbings. I mean, you know, enough's enough. People are at some point going to get angry. And what was their response? Their response was to go, ha, you bigots are wrong again. This was not done by an immigrant. It was done by a native British lad. And of course it turns out, oh, a first generation, he was born here on the magic dirt, which y'all claim anybody born here would just suddenly be British, to Rwandan parents that showed up in 2006. And they don't understand that by handling it that way, they actually threw fuel on the fire, and they continue to throw fuel on the fire. Now they come out and look at their response. You have three little girls get murdered, many more people seriously wounded. And they made their customary, solemn appearance, put some flowers down. But when people are understandably angry over it, then they're sitting there threatening everybody with the full force of the law. We will not allow this sort of racism and hooliganism. And they don't understand. They keep throwing fuel on the fire. These things can tend to take on a life of their own. This sort of anger boiling over can very much has a tendency to take on a life of its own. And you don't know where it's going to go. And these morons are just throwing fuel on the fire. You had people that voted for years for the Tories because the Tories said they were going to halt this immigration. And they never did. They finally threw their hands up and said, enough of this. Labour gets in there as a consequence of that. And of course, Labour's chief concern, They spoke but a few words over these murdered girls and those who were injured. But by golly, when people are angry about it, now they're front and center condemning the racism. It's like in the eyes of the people, these politicians have forgotten all about the actual victims, the actual murder victims. They're more upset. The perception is they're more upset and worried about people complaining about this immigration. And the immigration is what I wanted to, I thought we would discuss today. One of the disingenuous arguments that you'll hear from a leftist when you talk about immigration as being dangerous for society is they'll say, if you're an American, they'll say, oh, what about the Indians then? You should just give your country back to the Indians. And they act as though they've somehow owned you instead of making your point for you. These people are disingenuous. A better term is they're cynical. One of the mistakes conservatives make is they're constantly trying to point out liberals, leftists, as being hypocrites. Oh, look, you're a hypocrite. You don't really believe that. But they're not. It's not hypocrisy. It's cynicism. That's why that accusation of being a hypocrite doesn't work on them. Because they're not hypocrites. They're cynical. In other words, they don't actually believe any of the things they say. It is not a coincidence that they were all for free speech and the right to protest when it was they doing it. And now that it's you doing it, you get thrown in the gulag. It's not because they're not hypocrites. You're not going to win claiming they're hypocrites. It's cynicism. They're cynical. In other words, they never believed that in the first place. They were always lying to you. But for the sake of discussion, let's discuss about that point. What about the Indians, though? Or more specifically, a comparison, a difference to a difference with the doomed fight of the Indians and what that teaches us about history. And by history, you learn more about the world around you and you learn about the things you see. Immigration, well, we're going to learn from the Indians. We're going to learn from the Indians. We're going to learn from the red man. We're going to look at a difference between the Indians who were doomed from the get-go. We're going to learn from them and compare it to the world around us today. One of the first things we learn is that immigration is in many ways more dangerous than an army marching in. If you look at France today, look at Paris, and you look at the pictures of what Paris looked like when the Germans in the early parts of World War II marched in and took over. You look at the pictures of the streets of Paris, and honestly, it doesn't much look like any different from the streets of Paris before the Germans marched in. Now, because of immigration, you look at the streets of Paris today. We're talking just observable reality. You know, I'm telling you, go look. Go look at the pictures. Whoops, sorry, bumped my microphone. Sorry for the loud noise. That's because I wave my hands around continually when I talk as though y'all can see me. It doesn't make any sense. It's just the way I do. I can't help it. Anyway, I'm telling you, don't take my word for it. Go look at pictures of Paris under German occupation and Paris today. And tell me, what looks like a more destructive force, immigration or an army marching in? Now, because of immigration, the Indians were doomed from the get-go. They put up a fight, but they were doomed from the get-go. So I can look at these things without having to have this silly, who's the good guy, who's the bad guy? Oh, the red savages, you're supposed to look at them in a derisive manner because you're white, and that means they're on the other team and you don't like them. Look, they were doomed from the get-go, but they put up a fight. Nobody can sit here and say they didn't try. But you see, just as a matter of sheer numbers, the fight was decided beforehand. In other words, the outcome of the war was decided before it ever started, before the first arrow came off of the bow or the first bullet rolled out of the end of a rifle. The war was already decided just because of sheer numbers. Once mass immigration from Europe began in earnest into the New World, into what would become North America, the Indians had already lost. It was just a matter of time. You know, it's inevitable. I mean, you look around today. If today the American Indians said, we're taking our land back, we're raising an army and we're taking our land back, well, that would just be silly. They're so outnumbered, wouldn't it? See, this is why immigration is so dangerous to a people that are already living there. This is why it's so funny when a cynical leftist tries to score points by saying, then you should give the Indians back their land. You know, and they never even realize they're making your point for you. The Indians are not going to get back their land because they're numerically swamped by these other peoples. Now, the Indians put up a brave fight. They did. When they realized, at first they didn't realize, you know, you just have a few handfuls of these people showing up. And the Indians kind of say, well, these are some strange dudes. These pale faces are showing up. But, you know, they're a bunch of idiots. Heck, first winter, a bunch of them froze to death because they don't even know what they're doing. They're kind of silly looking. They didn't take it seriously. At some point along the road, as things deteriorated for the Indians due to immigration from Europe, they realized then they had a problem and they put up a fight. Now, difference is the Indians were ruled over by themselves. And you have to understand, they were not a monolithic group. It's kind of like when we'll talk about the Indians as if they're a monolithic group, sort of like we'll use the term white people instead of understanding that that's not a monolithic group. Swedes are different from Frenchmen and so on and so forth. You had the different Indian nations. You had the Comanche and the Apache. And they were, you know, worlds away different from some of the more docile, you know, Indian tribes. But one thing they had in common, each Indian tribe, and a better way to think of it is Indian nation. The Apaches were a different nation from the Comanche, from the Sioux, and so forth. But one thing they all had in common is they were ruled by their own people. The Sioux were ruled by Sioux chieftains. You know, the Comanche was ruled over, their leaders were Comanche. The Apache, and so on and so forth. Today, these nations, the white people's nations, are by and large not ruled by their own people. As I said on a recent Daily Nationalist, you know, the people making the decisions, the people actually setting policy and making decisions, are not the people you're voting for. Those are the front men. And that is observable. Again, that's one of those things that's observable reality now. This is why in Britain they just threw up their hands and said, well, there's no point. The Tories are just going to continue to do what the Labour Party does. There's no point in taking part in the facade anymore. Joe Biden may technically be the president, but white Americans are not being ruled over by white Americans. Your governments are not being ruled over by your chiefs. You're being ruled over, rather, by these other people. You know? Again, this points to how immigration, you know, even with the advantage of, I'm trying to think how I want to put this, even with the advantage that the Indians had, they had a homogenous society, which is the strongest society you can have. Comanche were ruled over by Comanche, Apache by Apache, and so on and so forth. They had that advantage, and it was an advantage. They had advantage of terrain and understanding the land around them. But at the end of the day, because of just sheer numbers, it didn't matter. Yes, they could go in and brutally slaughter white settlers on the plains. They could go in there and they look out there and there's like, there's some more of those pale face done. Set them up a little old crappy cabin out there. And there they are scratching in the dirt. And they ride in there and brutally slaughter all of them and burn their little cabin to the ground. But it didn't make any difference because of sheer numbers. Sheer numbers. Now, the Indians, they didn't invite these people here. Imagine the difference. The Indians, there were no Indian tribal leaders that were sending boats out. Imagine if your Indian tribe leaders had ships, had access to ships, and they were sending them to Europe. and passing out flyers over there. Come to the new world. It's an amazing place. And purposely bringing these people in. Again, this makes people feel uncomfortable to point out that this immigration is not something that's happening naturally. This person in Britain was from Rwanda. How did they get there? There's an ocean between. How did they get there? Oh, you're not supposed to. Oh, they get real awkward. They get real uncomfortable. They want to make you feel uncomfortable when you bring that up, don't they? Oh, you're fixing to get into some sort of conspiracy theory. There's no conspiracy theory. It's a question. I saw a deal a while back that here on the U.S. border and with Mexico, they were like, you know, you have all of these Africans there. That's a, how do people who are dirt poor from Africa wind up on the Mexican border with America? Somebody brought them here. I'm supposed to ask these questions. The Indians were not going out and bringing these pale faces into their country, were they? And yet, it didn't matter. Just by sheer numbers, these people coming in. Like I said, by the time the Indians realized what a threat it posed, it didn't matter anyway. I mean, yes, they put up a brave fight. You know, I'm not hailing settlers being slaughtered on the prairie, but they put up a brave fight. But it didn't matter. It didn't matter. If the Indians would have just rolled over, it didn't matter. By sheer numbers, the outcome of the conflict was decided at the beginning. The reason you never had Rwandans in Great Britain before is because they had no way to get there. Well, they didn't suddenly create a way to get there. Somebody brought them there. You know, that's a conspiracy theory. Come on now. That's common sense. Why weren't Rwandans flooding into Britain 50 years ago? Well, they didn't have a way to get there. Somebody is bringing them there. Now, again, with the Indians, they weren't doing that. They weren't doing that to themselves. And by sheer numbers, they lost. They were going to lose from the get-go. It's funny. They'll say, what about the Indians? Like, that's... See, leftists will always, because they're cynical and they don't believe any of this, they'll always try to derail the topic. They'll try to present you some moral, you know, moral dilemma that they themselves don't believe in. And yet they'll try to trip you up with that. If you talk about immigration as a weapon, then they say, well, what about the Indians? And you should, if you really believe that and you're not a hypocrite, you should offer to give your land back to the Indians. But that's completely and intentionally, cynically missing the point. The point is you should learn from these people who at least attempted to resist it compared to where you're at today. Well, and you're being led by disingenuous governments. Going back to talking about Britain. Now you have the angry protesters because of these killings, and now they're being met with counter protesters. How does that even work? You're protesting for the killings. You've got this situation to where they've brought in all of these different groups. Conflict is arising. And the government, instead of keeping the conflict down, is doing the one thing. That's why I keep saying they keep throwing fuel on the fire. They're intensifying the conflict by observably taking a side. That is the way people perceive it, and I believe they perceive it correctly. You know, you bring all of these different groups of people into close proximity to one another. There's always going to be conflict. There's always going to be friction. If you are going to try to keep the society, harmonious, as harmonious as possible, then you would try to, as a government, you would try to strictly keep things enforced equally. You know, you'd try to keep everybody equally enforced. The one thing you wouldn't do is you would want to appear to be taking a side. And yet when the government says very little about these British girls being murdered and these other people being seriously wounded, but then when anger flares up among the white British population, and then they jump up and start denouncing them and calling them names, that is perceived by those who are angry as the government is taking those other people's sides. And again, these politicians don't even realize that this is why they're throwing fuel on the fire. Anyway, it's interesting to look at, but I just thought, you know, the whole thing about what about the Indians, looking and comparing to what happened with the Indians is a very interesting way to look at it. Comparing their fight, their plight, to the plight of people being replaced by immigration today. Because, you know, it is. It's very much, I don't want to say inevitable. You get a critical mass of people. There was a critical, like I say, when there was just a few boats landed in the, you know, in the Northeast, you know, the Indians could snicker and laugh because it didn't really look like something. But when they started seeing all of these people, they realized, you know, they realized there was a problem. And by then it didn't matter. And ultimately, it didn't matter anyway. Once people in Europe heard about this vast open land just there for the taking, the waves of immigration began, and the Indians didn't have any way to stop it. You know, they didn't have any way to stop it. Their fate was ultimately sealed. Anyway, it's just an interesting discussion. I hope you found it interesting. We got to keep rolling. We got to get into the Christian specific segment. Time's flying. We're having so much fun. Time is flying. It's only going to get more fun. You know what to do. Get in there. Fill those pews. Let's get into this week's sermon at the Parish of the Patriots. And as we roll into the Christian specific segment this week, we roll right back into the listener supporter mailbag. GPD, one day I would like to hear your take on the Ten Commandments and how we interpret them. That's from Mr. T. Well, congratulations. Wait no more. One day is here, Mr. T. Yes, I decided to just go ahead and go through this. And I made that decision like minutes ago. Minutes ago, before I even started recording the show. You see, it's always more or less unscripted. I jot things down. But minutes before recording, we're just doing an entirely different segment. I have some other stuff jotted down that I thought we'd talk about. And we may do that. If not, we'll probably do it next week. No worries. So let's do this. I think that's a great idea. Sometimes you just pass over stuff, you know, not really thinking about it. And it's something you can go back. My sinuses are a mess this morning. So if I sound kind of, I always sound kind of funny when I have to listen to myself. Everybody's like that. You record yourself and then you hear recording yourself. But if I sound even more extra today, it's because my sinuses are a mess. I don't even know why. I have like a constant, y'all don't care. Anyway, go back. We're going to go back and go over things that we kind of just keep in the back of our minds thinking, yeah, we know all about that. But there's always more. I think it's a great idea. So we're going to do that. We're going to go ahead, start going through. We'll just go through these one at a time and just kind of discuss it and think about it a little bit. I'm sure there's more we could think about, more we could say on this topic. But yeah, I think it's definitely a fun exercise. So let's just jump right into it. Now, Commandments 1 and 2, almost, when you look at them, they almost look to be repetitive. It almost looks as though when we read that God is repeating himself. He's kind of saying the same thing. But it's not necessarily the case. We'll look at it. Commandment number 1. Number 1. Thou shalt, it's very short. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. It's a very blanket statement. Now, as we've talked about on this show, idolatry, having other gods, we use a blanket term of idolatry, and we'll get into this a little more here when we get to commandment number 2, the very next one. Because again, when you just kind of read through these, number 2 seems like it's connected, like it could be the same as number 1. But we've talked about before that idolatry takes on a lot of forms. We tend to think of it as, you know, when we think of it, when we read in the Old Testament, as somebody carving out an image out of wood, which reflects into commandment number two. And we think that's the only form. And as we've discussed before, it is not, such is not the case. It's what other gods do you have? It says, thou shalt have no other gods before me. In other words, in front of me. When you come before God, you should not have, because it doesn't mean you can have other gods, but the Lord comes first, and then those other gods can come later. Before him, in front of him, as you appear before him on the day of judgment, you shouldn't have any other gods before him. In other words, in front of him, he should not see you having other gods. Now, here in the West and in America, I've said that the number one god for the vast majority of people is money. They will do money and wealth. That is their god. You see these people, particularly women, but not only, who are addicted to attention on social media. I mean, that is what they live for. They do whatever. That is a god. It's a form of idolatry. It's what is it that drives you? What is it that is that your life is centered around? Those are things, those become gods. Those become false gods that you put your hope and your faith in. Remember how Jesus said that it is almost impossible for a rich man to get into the kingdom of God. It's not because God has a particular disdain for a wealthy man. It's because, by and large, a wealthy man, his god is going to be his wealth, his money. That's what he puts his hope and his faith in. So he's already kind of behind that eight ball, because that's generally going to be the case. There could be exceptions, of course, but generally a wealthy man will put his faith in his wealth. When things go sideways, he starts thinking, okay, how can my wealth solve this? When there's a problem, the first thing he wants to do is protect his wealth. Because a wealthy man will generally, that's his god. He, of course, is going to be in violation of commandment number one. He has another god before the Lord and in front of God. When God looks at him, this guy has another god that he puts forward. Again, this can take up, this can take up many forms, not just money. That's going to be one of the most common ones. You say, talk about, when people talk about other people, they'll often speak to how much money they have. You know, oh, he's well off, or he's broke, or they define people by money. This can be avoided, I believe, falling into this trap, because it's a human nature trap. This can be avoided, I believe, by and large, by keeping things in their proper perspective. You know, think that there are things in life that can bring you joy. If I woke up today and I had $50,000 in my bank account, well, that would help me out, like, a lot. But it is, in the end, meaningless. It will all disappear at some point. How much it would change? Yes, I pay for things and whatnot, but those are just things. It's not a life changing. It is not going to change the meaning of my life, because the meaning of my life is working towards the kingdom of God. So that wouldn't have anything to do with that. It would help, you know, pay for things and a certain amount of financial security, but is not going to change my life, because my life is moving towards the real life, the kingdom of God. Perspective, understanding what thing, you start thinking about things. We'll get into this and coveting here in a minute. Keep your perspective. Don't let things become a god, an idolatry. Don't let it become a god that is before the Lord. Let's keep moving here. And we get to number two. Thou shall not make unto thee any graven image, or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them. For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me, and shewing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. Now, this is speaking, I believe, this is speaking more specifically to the people that it was given to at that time. Remember, the Israelites were marching in and taking over these lands from these other races of quote-unquote people. And I've said this before, that when you really look into it, these are not people like what we think of people. You know, there were giants. They were all, I believe personally, this is something I personally believe, that by and large, most of these quote-unquote people were actually these, we would probably look at them as like a weird alien race if we saw them. But this, I believe, this commandment is specifically for the people that it was given to, the Israelites at that time. In other words, he's telling them, I'm giving you this. Do not then take up worshiping the images and the habits that start copying these people that I'm driving out before you. You know, that I'm giving you their land. You know, don't start copying them. Don't take up their images and start worshiping their false gods. Now, there's one part, this last part here. For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me, and shewing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. Now, people read this and misinterpret it, because we know it was written elsewhere that it is not the case. So people will misinterpret this, that the Lord is going to punish you because your grandpa was an asshole, you know, and because he was, you're getting punished for that. But that is not what it said here, because we know, again, it's written elsewhere that children are not responsible for the crimes of their parents. So what is the Lord saying here? What he's talking about is, what is being described here is the consequences, the iniquity, visiting the iniquities of the fathers up to with the third and fourth generation. In other words, the consequences of the iniquity someone commits can be, the consequences of that can be visited down multiple generations. A way to look at this is, here in the U.S., those who came before us, we look at the disastrous form of our societies today. And what you were looking at is the result of the iniquities of your forefathers being visited upon multiple generations later. You were looking at this being carried out, aren't you? You know, nobody in this generation up and decided, let's set up the Federal Reserve and hand all of our monetary policy over to these banks. Let's do that. Nobody has made that decision. You know, nobody around today made the decision, hey, let's let these folks come in and set up the Frankfurt School and get established at university. What could go wrong? Nobody, immigration policy, all these, you know, from years ago. Nobody in this generation has decided to do that, have they? You know, people will complain about, say, the 1965 Immigration Act. And, you know, they look at things now and they point to this as being one of those starting points. But yet, who around today actually signed off on that? I didn't. You didn't. I didn't make that decision. When I've talked about before, you know, I'm one of those people that enjoys giving the boomers a hard time as much or more than anybody. And yet, to be fair, a lot of the things that we complain about, the boomers didn't actually have, you know, in any direct, role in creating those things. But it doesn't change the fact that we're living with the consequences of that. That's what it means when it's written, the iniquities of the fathers. being carried down to the third and fourth generation. Our forefathers, which set up policies, made decisions, took the nation into wars that set things in motion that have ultimately resulted in where we are today. I didn't decide to, you know, let women vote, which I think is turned out to be a really bad idea. I didn't decide to. In fact, none of the people that decided to do that are even here. They're long dead. And yet we are living with the consequences of that to the third and fourth generation. That's what that means. It doesn't mean God goes around punishing for people, you know, for things that they haven't even done. But the second part says, he shows mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. This is the promise of repentance. This is the promise of, if you turn to the Lord, he will have mercy on you. This is how you escape that. This is how you overcome the iniquities that your fathers have visited upon you. I told you this would be fun. This would be interesting. That's really, you know, something to think about, isn't it? How it all fits together. How you can look at things today and it fits right back into this violation of commandment number two. We're living with the consequences of the decisions our forefathers make. I talk about the MCC. You know, we all know how the what passes for Christianity in so many cases today is nothing more than a heresy. And say, you know, you look back over the years, generationally, and way back there, you know, church leaders made mistakes. They thought it wouldn't hurt. We'll just compromise. We'll compromise on this and compromise on that. And now we see the results of it. Okay, let's keep going. Number three, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him blameless that taketh his name in vain. Now, if you're an English-speaking person, when you read that, there's a certain form of profanity, a certain term of profanity that pops to mind, and everybody thinks that is what this means. Vanity means what? It means pointlessness. If you are doing something in vain, you know, that means there's no actual point to your effort. It means that you're doing a pointless thing. It's ineffective. It's a vanity. I think one of the ways to frame this up and think of what it looks like. What does taking the Lord's name in vain look like? And you look at these mockers, you know, these people, you know, understanding a form of that today. These people who mock and say, oh, nothing's going to happen. Oh, the Lord isn't going to do anything. Where's your God now? Where is he now? Where's your God now? Well, those mockers who think, who act as though they will not be held responsible for their words. You always want to be really careful what comes out of your mouth. And we're living our lives and it's difficult to do. But as much as you can, you want to remember that which you speak has a certain amount of power. We're made in the image of God. God spoke time, the world as we know it, into existence. Because we're made in his image, we want to be very careful about what we, you know, what comes out of our mouths, because there's a certain amount of power there that we probably don't really understand. You speak things into existence on a certain level or not. I'm not obviously saying you can literally speak an object into existence, but what I am saying, your words have power. They have power on the things around you, and they have power on yourself and how you perceive them. Because again, we're made in the image of God, and we know that God spoke. In the beginning, there was the Word. God spoke the world into existence. If you were made in his image, that means your words on a certain level have power. You want to be really careful about what comes out of your mouth, because you're speaking a certain thing in existence. And you look at these non-believers, you look at these people who mock. When Jesus was drug before the scribes, the Pharisees, the elders, setting him up for execution. And one of the things they mocked him, you know, they threw like a blanket over his head and started punching him. Oh, prophecy, who hit you? Who prophecy now? In other words, where's your God? Oh, you're the Son of God? Well, tell us who hit you then. This is a form of taking the Lord's name in vain. It is a mockery. Oh yeah, where's your God? Where's your God? They didn't even realize they were in violation. The people doing that didn't even realize they were in violation. Now, obviously, those in authority didn't care. They didn't believe in any of that anyway. They were very cynical. But that is a form. Those who mock, those who sit here and ridicule, those who have a vehement hatred for the name of the Lord, they point it as vanity. In other words, they claim that God isn't going to do anything. You can do what you want. You're stupid. This is a joke. Your God isn't going to do anything. I'm going to live my life being the biggest sinful sack of shit that ever existed because God isn't going to do anything. Of course, this is vanity because they will answer for that. They will come face to face with the truth and everything will be stripped away. They will find that they spent their time that they're allotted in this world, that everybody is given the opportunity to use. They will find that they spent that time in vain. They didn't learn anything about the Lord. And once it's gone, there are no do-overs. You don't get to go back. You don't get a new allotment of time then to figure it out. It's burning all the time. And once the candle burns out, here's the results of your work. Yeah. You think of kids in school taking a test. If it's a timed test and they say, you've got 30 minutes to finish the test. At the end of the 30 minutes, the teacher's going to say, pencils down. And you say, if you're one of the students and you stand up and say, I need more time. You say, oh, okay, well, go ahead and take another 15 minutes then. No, once the time is up, that's it. The answers you didn't come to, too bad. You can't fill them. You don't get an allotment of more time. Those who take the name of the Lord in vain, they're burning their time up. They're burning their time up. They say, I'm not even taking the test. I don't care. What's going to happen? There'll be no consequence. And at the end, what they do is in vain because there will be. And once the time is gone, there's no going back and going, oh, I screwed up. Let me do that over. Their time is spent in vain. I'm absolutely determined to get through all of these. We run long, we run long. Number four, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work. But the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thy cattle, nor thy stranger that is within thy gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that is in them, all that in them is, and rested the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Now this one's real easy because we kind of get a cheat on this one. This one's very easy to understand because Jesus himself explained it to us, didn't he? He said, God made the Sabbath day for man, not man for the Sabbath. So in other words, what Jesus explained here is this is a matter of practicality. You cannot work yourself to death. You cannot, while it's fine to labor, the Lord said it that you have to take some time away from that. When you think of somebody that works 7 days a week all the time, you think of somebody who's an absolute workaholic, and all they do is their work. They've thrown their entire, you'll hear people talk about them, and they'll say they've thrown their whole life into their work. Yet, this would be another form of idolatry, wouldn't it? That is what they're living their life for, and it's something in vain because at the end of their life, that's not going to matter at all. The Lord is saying you've got to have a day of rest, and it's specified not just you, your animals, your workers, your servants, as it's written here, foreigners that are living within your gates. In other words, people from other places. You can't let them work 7 days a week either. If you're going to live here among us, this is what we do. We have a day when everybody takes off. Everybody, you've got to have a break from this. The other side, the spiritual aspect of this is that even though it's necessary to work, you know, you have to provide your substance, your sustenance. Ooh. You have to do this. You cannot seek the Lord while you're doing it. This is the problem. And this is the problem you run into even now in your Christian faith. As you seek out the Lord, it requires you turning off the worldly things for a little bit. When you're going to pray and you're going to set your heart on the Lord and try to understand the things of God, you cannot do that while you're at your job. You can't do that while you're driving down the road. You can't do that while people are talking in the background. You've got to have quiet. You've got to have time away from other people. You have to have some solitude. You have to put the things of this world out of your mind, the concerns of this world, things about work, things about your business, whatever the case may be. You got to put all that aside to be able to focus your heart back on the Lord, to get recentered back on God. The Lord is acknowledging in this commandment that while it's necessary for you to labor and do work, you've got to set time aside to reset your heart upon God, to try to understand Him, to open your heart up, to seek Him out. You cannot do that while you're busy doing work. That is the essence of it. You have to have this time to seek God. That's what it means. That is what this commandment means. Yes, you need to physically rest as well. You can't work your animals to death. You can't work your people to death. But spiritually speaking, you have got to have that time to recenter on God. You cannot forget God. You've got to take that time, shut everything else off, and think about the Lord. Recenter yourself on the Lord. Now, we know that the scribes and the Pharisees attempted to turn this into some mumbo-jumbo, you know, legalese. Look, your disciple picked a grain of wheat off a stalk and is eating it. He's in violation of the law. He's working, because we define that as work, and missing the whole point. The point is centering on the Lord. Number 5, honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. Again, Jesus gave us an example of this by using the contrast of what the Pharisees were doing. Jesus says, written to honor thy father and mother. In other words, to help them out financially so that they're not destitute. But the Pharisees said, oh, you could just say, what I could have given them is a gift to God so I can keep it to myself. And since God's not here, I can use it however I want to. To help them out. This is about familial, and as such, by extension, I should say, societal cohesion. You take care of your family first and foremost. Can you imagine, for instance, just to use kind of more of a, I don't want to put it, kind of an extreme example, but to understand it, to illustrate it. Can you imagine you yourself, you are living, you're wealthy. You've done well in life. You find yourself, you're actually quite wealthy. You've got a lot of money in the bank. You're doing well. You're financially set. And then if one were to go look at your mom and daddy, the very people who are responsible for bringing you into this world, regardless of your relationship with them, and your mom and daddy are living in absolute destitute poverty. In fact, they're homeless on the street. Now, would anybody look at you and say, you're honoring your mother and father? No, they would say, what is wrong with you? You've got all of this wealth. You've got all of this wealth, and your mom and daddy are living in a tent under a bridge because they're destitute. They're poor. They've lost everything. And yet you don't honor them at all. You're just keeping the money for yourself. It's an extreme example. Everything in the Bible is about action. It's not about your feels. It's everything is about action. So if you, in this example, you have great wealth and the ability to help them not be destitute and poor, and you refuse to do that because you want to keep that for yourself, then you're in violation of not honoring them because of what you do, or in this case, what you're refusing to do. You have the ability to do it, and you're not doing it. You know, it doesn't have to be just a thing with money. That's just an example. It's what you do, how you honor, what do you do? What do you choose to do, you know, that you can do towards them, how you treat them. I think that one's pretty understandable. I don't think we need to spend a lot of time on it. Number six, thou shalt not kill. Shedding blood, thou shalt not kill. Pretty straightforward. Then you look in the context of, at that time, God was also telling the Israelites, march in here and wipe all of these weird alien-like people off, because they're not supposed to be here anyway. Go in there and wipe them all off. It seems, again, that's some sort of contradiction, right? God said, thou shalt not kill. And then he would also say, well, when you take this city, I mean, don't leave a thing living here. Burn everything to the ground. You're just going to start over from scratch. So it seems like a contradiction. We should always remember that the natural order is things that God created. I really weary myself of people that try to make these things, they intentionally make these things complicated when they're not. God didn't. When you look at something and says, well, it seems to me like common sense would say, okay, there's your first starting spot to try to understand. You know, because a lot of times when people, not always, but a lot of times when people say, use the term like common sense, what they're trying to articulate, and maybe perhaps aren't, is that it seems like according to the natural order, this and this would be the case. And the natural order is created by God. So if the natural order points and says, this is the way things should be, that's a good clue. It's a good hint, because the natural order is the laws that God has set up. God has so if your interpretation of something seems outside of the natural order of things. For instance, you're in your house. You're minding your own business. Somebody comes busting through the door into your house with a crowbar, running at you. You pull your pistol and send them to the next life. You send them to the dead. That person just found the day of the Lord today. Are you in some sort of violation? Have you done something evil? Have you done something wrong? Well, the natural order, again, many people would articulate this as common sense, but that really isn't correct. But we try to speak, you know, we try to articulate things the best we can. But the natural order tells us, well, no, that person's not in violation of God. This guy kicked your door in. He's a violent person, obvious. He violently kicked your door in. He's posing a threat to you and your family, and you just sent him to the day of the Lord to answer for that. You think you have violated the commandment to not kill because you did kill this person. Well, that doesn't seem right, does it? According to the natural order, that doesn't seem correct. Now let's flip the scenario over. Let's say you decide to go kick somebody's door in and take their stuff. You go and kick their door in. They're at home, so you go ahead and kill them so that you can take their stuff without being interrupted. Now, do you think you're in violation of that? Well, of course. You violently went in there and you violently killed. We know the story of Cain and Abel, the first murder, and the circumstances around that. That was a murder. It was a killing. It's not the same as defending yourself. Somebody might would say, well, you're oversimplifying that. No, you have to be very careful. Understand, just because you don't like somebody doesn't mean, you know, you hear people use, again, you want to be careful about the words that you speak. We have to learn this lesson. Your words have power. How often will people carelessly say, I can't stand that guy. I'd just kill that guy. Man, I could just kill him for being such an idiot. Of course, you don't mean you plan to murder them. We understand that. But understand that your words have a certain amount of power. In other words, just because you don't like somebody doesn't mean that you should go kill them. Again, you might wouldn't necessarily do that, but you want to be careful of what kind of things you're speaking out. I hope that makes sense. To say, well, you you're not using this. You're not. You always want to be careful when you're understanding these things that you're not trying to turn them into meaning whatever you want them to be. Just because you don't like somebody doesn't mean you should go kill them. And we used an extreme example of someone breaking into your home. But just because these people live across the street and I can't stand that guy. I really absolutely can't stand him. Every time I see that guy, every time I've had to talk to him, I can't stand him. Just because you don't like somebody doesn't mean, well, that means you can go kill them. It's pretty straightforward. Let's go to number 7. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Oh, this one's more complicated than you think. This looks very simplistic. People look at this and say, well, that means don't be a cheating. Yes, but. Yes, but. Cause I like to understand these things. I always seek to understand the Lord. And something that looks complicated can often be understood in a more simplistic manner. And likewise, things that you look at here, and you say, well, that's it's a very simple, straightforward thing. Don't be a cheating. It actually can have a more complicated understanding. What does it mean? Thou shalt not commit adultery. We run into a problem, as I pointed out, marriage in the biblical sense of when this was written does not exist today. People, a lot of people struggle with the concept of marriage and whatnot in today's world because marriage, as it's in the Bible, doesn't exist. Marriage today is conducted not before God, but before the state. The state has placed itself above God here and has taken over something that was traditionally done by the church, traditionally handled among the people, traditionally done before God. So you start getting those things convoluted, and then when they don't make sense, you throw up your hands. Well, it's because marriage, in the biblical sense, doesn't even exist today. I think an important way to understand do not commit adultery, this is speaking primarily to, and we're going to get into why this is so, this is speaking primarily to what? Cuckoldry. In other words, cucking. I've seen, and I'm sure you have too, articles, news articles, and stories where they've done these studies, and up to like a certain percentage, I don't remember the number at all, but it was a disturbing percentage of men, married men in this country today are raising children, unbeknownst to them, they're raising children that are not even theirs. They think it is. These are my kids. And you've heard stories, you've read stories where, for instance, their child, this man has raised this child for years, and now this child is, say, a teenager, and they need a bone marrow transplant. Well, it has to be done by an immediate family member, and the father's like, no problem, sign me up, I'm gonna save my kid. And they go in there, and then the doctor comes in and says, well, we can't use your bone marrow. And he's like, well, why not? Because this isn't your child. You've been raising this child your whole life. You thought this was your child. Guess what? Your wife is a cheating whore, and you've been cuckolded. This is where adultery comes in. If you look at the Bible, there's a reason the primary examples of adultery are always cheating with your neighbor's wife, you know, having sex with your neighbor's wife, because you're cuckolding your neighbor. You were taking the potential of impregnating her. We know David's downfall, David's sin that got him into so much trouble. He cuckolded one of his men, had sex with his wife while the man was out on the battlefield, and got her pregnant. And then attempted, what did he attempt to do? He had the guy come back and say, oh, it's good to have you back. Go, be sure and go sleep with your wife, because he was trying to cover up. He was literally trying to cuck this guy who was a loyal servant. This is what do not commit adultery is primarily focused for. Now, people be triggered by this. They say, oh, so you're saying men then, as long as they're not sleeping around with a married woman, they're not committing adultery. This is where you get to the definition of marriage. In those times, if a man went out to a woman, not a prostitute, and slept with her, you know, had sex with her, that was the marriage act. All that meant in those days was, it wasn't, oh, so-and-so was cheating on his wife. It was, so-and-so has taken a second wife. The woman isn't giving it up just for recreational purposes. You can't apply traditional times to clown world today and have it make sense. Because the woman he has had sex with, she wasn't doing that recreationally. She was doing that to be married. That was the marriage act. Once you slept with her, once you had sex with her, she's yours now, buddy. So people wouldn't be saying Joe was screwing around on his old lady. No, they would say, oh, well, did you hear Joe took a second wife? This was, again, a common thing in those times. So, no, it would not be adultery because he took a second wife. And when she turns up pregnant, there we go. There's no cuckoldry here. This is understanding these things in the concept of the time and of a traditional time. You can't apply them today. If a man, you know, like I said, in those days, having sex with the woman, with the young woman, was the act of marriage. If a man took a virgin to wife and she wasn't a virgin, the whole deal was off. I mean, that was it. There was no marriage because somebody tried to pull a fast one. Now, there's other instances a man would take his, you know, it was a tradition to where if a brother had a wife and he died without fathering any children, you were supposed to take his wife yourself to try to carry on his name, to try to carry on his behalf. That's getting into something else. The whole point here is to understand thou shalt not commit adultery. It needs to be understood in the context of cuckoldry. Number 8, thou shalt not steal. I don't need to explain that. That one is straight up. Plus, I'm running way long. Number 9, thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. Don't be spreading rumors. Don't go into court, and because you're scheming with someone else to take your neighbor's stuff, you're going to bear false witness. You just stand up and bear false witness, you lie, because you're scheming. You like tearing somebody down. You're going to go. You don't care what the truth is. Care about getting that person. Let's hit number 10 so we can get through all of this here. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, nor his manservant, nor his maidservant, nor his ox, his ass, nor anything that is thy neighbor's. Again, Jesus gave us a great example of this. When Jesus said, it is written, do not commit adultery, but I say anyone who's looked upon their neighbor's wife, has looked upon a woman lustfully, has already committed adultery. When he says a woman, he means a married woman. When you look upon your neighbor's wife lustfully, he's already committed adultery in his heart. Covetousness is where sin comes from. Sin doesn't just pop up out of the blue. It's like a plant. It starts from a seed, and that seed is covetousness. You commit adultery because what? You're looking at your neighbor's old lady and think, man, she fine. Dang, I bet that's so good. And then you get the opportunity, and the next thing you know, there you are. Theft. Oh, man, I'm obsessed with, I just had a new car, and then you get the opportunity, perhaps, to steal one. Covetousness, do not covet. This is where idolatry, placing other gods, you're so obsessed with something other people have, and you just know if you had it, your life would be perfect. You've created an idol. You have put that thing before God. You have created a god before God. If that makes sense, you have created another god before the Lord, because you just know that thing. You see, in a lot of ways, a lot of these other violations, number 10 points to the seed that all of 1 through 9 violations sprouts from. Covetousness. When you look and you lust after things that other people have. Again, Jesus laid that out very clearly. You've already committed the adultery in your heart because you're coveting. You're looking at it. You're looking at this woman. You're looking at your neighbor's wife lustfully. If you don't do that, and then one day she shows up at your front door out of the blue, and you're like, why is my neighbor's wife over here? And you're like, can I help you? And she's like, flashes a little cleavage at you. And it's like, well, you know, I got a little wine. I was wondering if you'd like to share it. You'd be like, no, not right now. I'm busy. Ooh, I'm busy. I'm busy doing something. I ain't got time to talk to you. And you shutting that door. But you've been spending your time looking at her over there going, what's she wearing today? She's looking good. See, that's the difference. The seed it comes from. A lot of these other commandments are violated. The seed for those violations, the seed for sin, it begins with covetousness. We got to wrap up. I appreciate you, Mr. T. It wound up being a long discussion, longer than I thought it'd be. Imagine that. No huge shock there. But I do appreciate the suggestion. I think it was a fun discussion, enlightening. Always good stuff. Thank you all for joining us, for being here. I hope you got something out of the entirety of the show. Appreciate you being here. And as always, I hope to see you here next week for the Parish of the Patriots.